had quite a good discussion last week as we concluded our class. We spent a lot of the time talking about Barak, who works alongside Deborah in Judges chapter 4 to bring about the deliverance of the children of Israel. We're going to actually read the story of that deliverance through the hands of Barak, Deborah, and the Lord this morning. But we came, I think, as a general consensus to the conclusion that although sometimes we may paint Barak with the brush of one who seems unbelieving on the surface because of his initial hesitation to go immediately with Deborah whenever the Lord calls him out to go to battle, we find him mentioned over in Hebrews chapter 11, and I think that helps us really understand the true colors of Barak. And one of the things, is characters like Barak. You know, we often read about characters that just do tremendous things, whose faith just seems unrivaled. And we look at them and think, well, I can never be like them. I can never demonstrate faith like that. But as we read about men like Barak, we see men in very human moments. People, I don't know about you, but people that I look at and I can relate to. People whose flaws we're able to see. And although, yes, he was a man of faith, whose faith was to be commended, at the same time, that faith was, he questioned his faith for a moment there, rather than going out immediately at the word of the Lord and the summon of Deborah. He was a little bit hesitant, said, I'm not going to battle, Deborah, unless you come with me. And we find ourselves probably just at different times in our life, very much relating to Barak, that our faith may not be exactly what it needs to be. And so it's good reminders for us to read about characters like that, who although they were faithful and obedient and were great examples for us, at the same time, we see them dealing with struggles and challenges all their own, just the same way we do, and we can very much relate to them. So let's conclude our story beginning in Judges chapter 4, verses 11 through 16. Homer, would you mind reading that text for us, please? Judges 4, 11 through 16. All right, let's look at a map so we can gain a little bit of perspective as we're putting together the details of this account regarding the battle that took place between Barak and the Israelites and Sisera of King Jabin. So let me actually see if we can zoom in a little bit there. We find out, remember, King Jabin is located at Hazor, is stationed up there around or in the province of Naphtali. This is where King Jabin, who was oppressing the Israelites at this time, was residing. And now remember, Barak, we go and read early in the chapter, we find out he was from Kadesh Naphtali. Kadesh is actually a relatively common name. In the territory of Israel, there are other Kadeshes. And so not to be confused with the Kadesh at which Barak was located, we see here it's specified that he was located at Kadesh Naphtali. And the word comes to the Lord comes to Deborah the prophetess, and she summons Barak and gives this message that he's to take 10,000 men and he is to march to Mount Tabor, as it's translated in ours. This particular map translates it a little bit differently, but that's the location. He was to take 10,000 men and to march from Kadesh down to Mount Tabor. And where we find out Sisera and his men were at, they were going to be in the area of Hagasheth Hagoyim, I believe is as best I can pronounce that. And we don't have that marked on our map, but it's that little red dot down there right in the southeast corner of the tribe of Asher. And we're going to see how relevant it is, the location of that, here in just a moment. He rallies his troops and his 900 iron chariots with which he's been oppressing Israel at the Kishon River. So we read a little bit about the text there, and we have geographically an idea. Whenever Sisera gets wind that Barak, the Israelite, is marching with 10,000 troops down to Mount Tabor, he gathers his forces at the river Kishon. Now remember, we talked about how technologically this should have been an easy victory for Sisera. He had those 900 iron chariots. Their technology was superior to that the Israelites had. In fact, we're going to find out just how bad it was for the Israelites when we come over to chapter 5, when we see really the status of the country and what they were going up against, these 900 iron chariots and the weaponry that they had at their disposal. And so by all accounts, it should have been an easy victory for Sisera. So he mounts his troops at the river Kishon, and he prepares to meet Barak at Mount Tabor. I want to take just a side detour here and help us think about something that we notice about God here that really clashes perhaps with our perspective and our view of God, especially in Western civilization. In Western civilization, the idea or the imagery that we get about regarding God is that God is kind and he's nice and he's gentle and he's soft. And this is really evidenced as people come to read about the stories of God in the Old Testament. They're quite surprised and they're quite bothered by some of the things that they see God doing. And that just kind of tells you the how we view God is not necessarily how the Bible paints for us a picture about God. Teddy Roosevelt was teaching a Bible class once, a children's Bible class, and one of his students came in with a black eye. And he noticed that and he asked the little boy what had happened. And the little boy said, "This other boy in the class was picking on my sister. And I stepped up and I told him to leave her alone." And the other little boy blacked his eye because he did that. Teddy Roosevelt took out a dollar bill and gave it to the little boy that stood up for his sister because he wanted to reinforce that idea of standing up for those who were helpless and defenseless. When the church that he was teaching class for found out about what he did, they removed him from his teaching privilege in that class. Because this idea and this imagery that we oftentimes have about God is that God is gentle and God is soft and God is kind and God is love. And while in a sense God is all those things, when you come over to the book of Judges and other Old Testament books, really forced to change the way that we think about that we think about God. Look at verse 14. Did you notice the phraseology that was used there? Was Deborah speaking to Barak? She says, "Arise, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you." That is, he's gone out in war before you. You know, unless the Lord goes out before the children of Israel, they're not going to have a chance at victory. But it was God who was going out before the people. And this really forces us to break the idea that God is nothing but kind and gentle and soft, and man, he wouldn't hurt a fly. You go over to the book of Revelation, chapter 19 and verse 11. And John paints this picture for us of God that really flies in the face of perhaps how many in this country think about God. He says, "I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat on it was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war." You know, how do you reconcile perhaps two diametrically opposed natures or characteristics? That is, God who is love and at the same time a God who judges, a God who makes war against his enemies and overthrows them in battle. And I think it's perhaps a matter of perspective. You know, Prince and the Pauper, I love reading Mark Twain, and one of my favorite books by Mark Twain is The Prince and the Pauper. And you've got there, I've talked a little bit about it to our regular audience before, you've got there a young boy that was born in the streets in England, and he was poor, grew up in poverty, and he comes across the Prince of Wales, and they end up trading places because they look very similar. And King Henry VIII is the king at the time in the story, and he was very feared by his people, by the people of that he governed, because of his brutality and because of his dealing with them and his violence oftentimes toward them. He's very feared by the people. But there's a scene in the book where the imposter, the son of the imposter that's in the place of the Prince of Wales, goes before the king, and it's the first time he's met him. The king thinks it's his son, but he falls down. He's just terrified because he heard the terrible stories about King Henry VIII, and he's just begging and pleading for his life. And this man who is so feared by the people, this king that's so feared by the people, just takes who he thinks is his son and he wraps him in his arms and he says, "You know, you don't have nothing to worry about. I'm your father. I love you. I'm not going to hurt you." And that's oftentimes how it is with God. You've got, on one hand, perhaps it depends on where you stand in relation to God. If you are an enemy and you choose to oppose God, then yes, you might expect perhaps God to go to war in a sense against you. If you set yourself opposed to him and his work and the things that he has commanded. But on the other hand, if you are his child, then you can experience the love and the comfort and the protection, on the other hand, that we talk about and that we describe God as having. And so if you think about it, you think about perhaps what God has done for us in the work of salvation. Salvation, while we may think of it in the terms of love and grace and mercy, salvation is God's holy war against sin. And when people go to war, people die for the cause of war. And that's what happened whenever the means that we have salvation. Satan drew first blood. Jesus died on the cross so that salvation could be given to you and I. He was, in a sense, the first casualty of war. But without the sacrifice of Jesus and without his death, that's a war that we had no hope of winning. And so while war is violent, while there are casualties, and while it's not necessarily a pretty sight, God gives us weapons. And we need to remember that God goes out before us in war. And let's never just totally paint God with this brush of kindness and gentleness and love, and not forget other sides of God that we read about in the Bible. So in verse 14, we have the Lord going out before Barak from Mount Tabor to meet Sisera with his chariots of iron. Let's think about one of our questions. And I probably need to stop talking so much, so if anybody could lecture for 10 minutes or so on this question, you'd very much have my appreciation. How was Barak and his army able to overthrow Sisera and his iron chariots? And what was God's involvement? Okay. My version, verse 15, says the Lord routed Sisera and his chariots. And routed can be translated as confused, like you say. Dave?
Chapter 5, you've never seen that song.
Say again?
She refers to the water rising.
Okay.
And so that could have been played a role in it too.
I agree with you. I think we do find the answer. More precisely, as we read this, you know, the imagery is described of God going out before the people. But I think chapter 5 is going to help us have a greater understanding of how that actually came to pass. You know, this phrase here that he confused the chariots, or he routed the chariots of Sisera and his men. If you go back to Exodus 14, 24 and 25, we have there the same language used. In fact, it's nearly a very similar picture that's painted. And you'll remember that's where the children of Israel have escaped from Egypt, and Pharaoh and his army have decided, you know, we shouldn't have let them go. We should have kept them here. We're just sending these people away that have served us and built our facilities and worked for us for hundreds of years. And so he says, we need to go after them. And so he mounts his chariots and he goes chasing after the children of Israel. And the children of Israel had just previously crossed over the Red Sea. God had caused the waters to be parted. And we come over to Exodus 14, 14 and 15. We find out the Lord will fight for you, Moses is told. And then Moses speaks to the people and he tells them to then go across. And what happens with the children of Israel, as they cross the Red Sea, God confuses, he fights for the Israelites, God confuses the chariots of Pharaoh. And we find out that they are all crushed by the Red Sea as it closes down. Dave? The chariots were those advantages. That was the technology. That was the gun versus the sword. The chariot gave them the benefit of weaponry and warfare. John? Good point. What happens whenever the general flees the battle? Well, you can bet everybody else is probably, for the most part, going to flee the battle as well. And we had our map here just a minute ago. I said that, well, I'm going to go ahead and jump just a little bit into Judges 5. But in Judges, remember, Judges 4 and Judges 5 are parallel stories. Judges chapter 4 is the narrative of what happens as God frees them from the oppression of Jabin. Judges 5 is a song that Deborah sings and gives us a little different perspective. Perhaps the poetic prose of the events that happened. Remember that little bitty detail that Sisera gathered his troops and his chariots and he goes there to the river Kishon. Well, what we find out in chapter 5 is that the river of Kishon at that time flooded its banks. And as John had mentioned, Sisera, one of the details where Sisera jumped out of his chariot and began to run. And the reason he did that is because as the river flowed its banks, well, you can imagine how well those chariots drove in the flooded banks in which they were trying to drive. It would render the chariots completely ineffective. And so all of a sudden, that warfare, that advantage that they have was no longer there. And he forsakes his chariot because, of course, it would get stuck in the mud as it tried rolling along. And he was forced to flee on foot. But it was because of a great torrent that came about. Deborah's going to kind of describe it in poetic writing in chapter 5 that caused this particular river to flood its banks and to render the chariots of Sisera and of his men useless. So Barak then in turn chased the chariots back to Sisera's headquarters and completely destroyed the army, utterly destroyed the people, and probably largely in part the will of the people to fight and to resist after they saw their general flee on foot and leave them behind. To the Israelites probably didn't just give them a whole lot of confidence and a whole lot of hope, and so they were able to destroy the rest of the army that belonged to Sisera. And so the general himself escapes on foot. Look at verse 11. Verse 11 offers us probably just a detail in a casual reading that we don't even think about. It's just some geographical insert that was put there by the narrator that doesn't mean just a whole lot and doesn't do just a whole lot for you and I, but we're going to come back and we're going to see the relevance of verse 11, where we find out as the narrator just inserts in the story, Heber the Kenite had separated himself from the Kenites, from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and he had pitched his tent as far away as the oak of Zaanim, which is near Kadesh. So just to kind of give you an idea, and we'll see how this is relevant here in just a moment. You've got there initially where the Kenites settled was down in the southern portion of the land that belonged to Judah. You can see them kind of settling down there very close to the tribe of Simeon. That's by and large where the Kenites settled. But this particular Kenite, we're told, it says he separated himself from his people and he moved up north to the area of Kadesh. Now, I told you that Kadesh is a very common name in the land of Israel. And the best bet of people who have looked into this a whole lot more than I have is that it was a little bit closer, a little bit further south than Kadesh of Naphtali, and that's the Sea of Galilee right there to let you know where we are. That's where they speculate that Kadesh, where the Kenite and his family fled to. Now, this is relevant all of a sudden because, remember, that was where the battle took place on Mount Tabor. So all of a sudden, Sisera was in very close proximity where he's able to find a refuge and a safe place as he prepares to flee. So verse 11 is a detail that we're going to come back to, and you'll understand the significance of perhaps what might seem just kind of a meaningless piece of geography as we conclude the story. Any comments or questions on verses 11 through 16 before we move on to the conclusion of the chapter? All right, let's finish it with verses 17 through 24. Brother Barker, would you mind reading that for us? So that little irrelevant detail back in verse 11 that tells us that this Kenite had moved away from his people up north to what's known as Kerbet Kadesh, which is a little south of Galilee, put him in very close proximity to Mount Tabor, where the battle was going to take place that Barak and his army was told that they were to march toward. And remember, Sisera, because of the flooded Kishon River, was forced to vacate his chariot and to flee on foot. Now, we find out a detail in verse 17 that helps us understand the significance of verse 11. As Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, we see that there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. That's putting it mildly. A better understanding of the relationship that existed between King Jabin and this Kenite that we read about, Heber, was that they had somewhat of an alliance formed. So it wasn't that there was just pieces, not there was a lack of open hostility between, but rather there seemed to be some sort of a military alliance between this particular man here, this Kenite, and Jabin. So Sisera, knowing that, knowing his army has been defeated, is going to seek out the first safe place he can. And he knows that there's safety here if he goes to the house of Heber the Kenite. And so he flees the scene, he flees the the battle, and he heads to the home of Heber and of Jael. So we find here the actions of Jael quite puzzling as you read about this and as you think about this. There's a whole lot that we just don't know. Why it was that she did what she did. She's wife to a man who was in league with King Jabin, the oppressors of the children of Israel. However, very obviously, it seems that her loyalty is not to the loyalty of her husband, but rather to the loyalty of the Israelites. Because we see here how she acts whenever the enemy of the Israelites comes to her home. So she brings Sisera into her tent. She allows him to rest, and he asks for something to drink. She gives him milk. There's been a lot of speculation as to what in the world that particular detail meant. Some have suggested, well, she's trying to maintain control over the situation. She meets him. She welcomes him into the tent. He asks for water. No, you're not getting water. I'm going to give you milk. And so some have thought, well, she was trying to maintain control in the events as they were transpiring. There have been some who have thought, well, milk has somewhat of a sleep-inducing effect, if you think about it. Personally, I don't drink milk. The only effect milk has on me is a gag effect. So I really don't drink milk at all. But some people, I assume, or I hear, maybe take a glass of milk before they go to bed because they believe that'll help them sleep better. And personally, I can't relate to that. But maybe that's why she offered him milk rather than water when he asked for something to drink. Anybody have any thoughts on that as to why that might have been? Just gonna, Dave, take a shot. Well, yeah. One of the things I've heard about anything for that matter, other than the water, if you're really tired, you're really hot, and this guy was exhausted, he'd been running from battle, and you can just imagine how he arrives there out of breath. If you drink anything other than water, it seems like in large quantity, it can make you sick. If you're overheated or if you're exhausted or something like that, and so water is really the best thing for you if you find yourself in a circumstance where you're physically exhausted. Whatever the case may have been, for whatever reason, she chooses to give him a glass of milk. So he falls into this deep sleep because of his exhaustion. She takes this tent peg and this hammer, and she drives it through his head. So a couple of things very briefly. You see the providence of God back in verse 11, where Heber the Kenite separated from his people and moved up to Kerbet Kadesh, put himself right in the position where Sisera and his reign and his oppression of the children of Israel was going to be brought to an end by the actions of the woman Jael. So you see kind of God's providence in doing that. You know, it seems like a meaningless detail to us, but God works in the most mysterious ways. And so through the seemingly irrelevant event, this woman brings about the end of the oppressor of the children of Israel. And secondly, it really helps us understand what Deborah was saying earlier. Remember whenever Barak refused to go to war initially without Deborah, she said, fine, the honor won't go to you. The honor is going to end up going to a woman because of your refusal to go to war at the command of the Lord. Well, we think for the longest time that's going to be Deborah because she's the prophetess. She's the word of God. She speaks as the mouth of God. And so we think, okay, Deborah's going to be the one that receives the honor. Well, No, it wasn't. We find out that the honor is actually brought to this woman, Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. So the reader's left in a little bit of surprise as we find Jael being the instrument that brings the reign of King Jabin and his general Sisera to an end. Any comments or thoughts on that before we have another question? All right, I figured I'd stir the pot a little bit with this one. Question 7. Are Jael's actions that of a hero or of a villain? Are they moral or immoral? Okay, that particular question, yeah. So if you're of King Jabin, then she probably wasn't your buddy. For that matter, if you were her husband, she probably wasn't on the same side that you were on. Right, definitely perspective has something to do with that. To the Israelites, she was a hero, and as we're going to see, she's hailed and she's praised in Deborah's song that they sing in celebration of their victory at the hand of Jael. Any other, Dave? Okay, a harder question that I don't blame y'all for dodging. Were her actions moral or immoral? Okay, what does she do that we would translate into, well, these things are wrong? Just in general, everyday conversation, God says these things are wrong. What's she doing? All right.
Murder.
What's that?
Murder.
Okay, murder. Murder.
Deceived him.
Okay. Dave, I guess you were going to say that too. Yeah, so I mean that's kind of two elements we see, very similar to the event of what takes place in Joshua 6 with Rahab, and the people there. A lot of people want to say, well, you've got on one hand Rahab who lies, and you got Jael here who deceives and who lies. The particular act of, was it murder? Was it an act of war? Was it a casualty that came about because it was a time of war? Yeah, I don't know. There are a lot of people that look at this and say, well, this is betrayal, this is deceit, this is murder, this is all of these terrible things. And very frankly, the Bible doesn't pass judgment on the morality of Jael's actions, simply as it doesn't pass morality or judgment on the morality of Rahab's actions. It's sometimes tough to translate between things we see in the Old Testament, things we see in the New. We know that under the New Testament, deceit and lying, those are things that we as Christians are to have no part of. However, when you come back here to these particular days, you don't see the Bible exactly blessing her for lying and killing this man, but at the same time, you don't see it condemning her either. So regarding the morality of it, we simply don't know. God tells us that lying is wrong, yes. God tells us that murder is wrong, yes. But let us also not forget at the same time that God has used those through who have performed other wicked actions to bring about his will before. And so the Bible simply doesn't pass judgment. I don't think that's the point of the story here for us to look at Jael and say she's a sinner for lying to her enemy, even in a time of war. And at the same time, we dare not walk away with this idea of situation ethics and say, well, based off of the circumstance, her lying and her killing were something that were justified because of the circumstances that she were in. And so the Bible doesn't really speak to this one way or the other. Any other thoughts, comments on anything we've looked at in chapter 4?
Just in respect of morality, time of war, and killing is part of war.
We definitely see it as a major part of war in the Old Testament. And of course, to take and to translate that into our life and to justify perhaps our own disobedience in a time outside of that, that's absolutely unpermissible. Dave? She freed God's people. And so we see the way that God worked in delivering the children of Israel through the hands of Jael. So thank everyone for their participation in our class. Grab the questions. Those of us will be back next week for chapter 5. And we'll jump into chapter 5 next week.